Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Item one, the week that was. Items two through four, taxes, big oil, and graduation speeches, although not, I think, in that order. Item number five, the highlight of 30 years in the ad game. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 21st of March. Great to have you here, as always, everybody. You know, there are weeks where, to be totally honest with you, it's just tough to pull together 4 minutes of live radio to sum things up, because sometimes stuff just doesn't happen. This week, no problem at all. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville, and I will have plenty to talk about. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai. Hey, Kai.
We will start, of course, with Fed Chair Janet Yellen. Catherine, first press conference after her first meeting as the head of the Fed. Item one, the subjective question, how do you think she did?
I think she didn't do as well as maybe she hoped she would.
Really? Ooh. Wow. That's unusual coming from you.
Well, she spooked markets. You know, so yeah. part of her job is to not make news as Fed chair and to keep things, sort of running as smoothly as possible in terms of public communications. And she made kind of an offhand comment about what a considerable period of time means in terms of when rate hikes might happen.
Yep.
And I don't think she really intended it to be as definitive as markets interpreted it to be and then kind of freaked out.
Well, so Cardiff, she said 6 months or so, that kind of thing, maybe sort of. I'm extrapolating here. I gave her some grief on the air. Lots of other people did. The markets went down, you know, like 190-something points.
Sure.
Did she blow it?
I think she stumbled a bit. I agree with Catherine on that point. All the same, she immediately tried to layer on the caveats right after she said it. She tried to make it clear that the date that rates would start being hiked was dependent on the data. The markets didn't actually pay attention to that, but I actually believe her. And if you take it into the, if you put it against the context of everything else she said, I think it's clear to me that she still really is very worried about unemployment, much more so than she's worried about inflation. That being said, as Catherine noted, a big part of her job is to communicate well to the markets. It's very dangerous to make name an explicit target if specificity isn't called for, as it wasn't in this case. And so, yeah, it was a mistake. It was a stumble.
Which is kind of bananas. I have here a note in front of me that says, is the market an idiot? I mean, they should have known, right, Catherine, that they have to listen to the whole context? Yes, no?
One would think, and she did have a lot of caveats, a lot of qualifiers, kind of, sort of, maybe. It depends on the data. The same kind of language that she and her predecessor frequently used and that the statement itself uses. But it's like the market kind of honed in on that one number. I mean, and the other weird thing about how much attention was paid to that 6 month figure is that on a panel today, another Fed official, Jim Bullard, made a comment about how, you know, was it weird that that 6 months was mentioned?
Right.
And he said that in private surveys, his impression was that 6 months is what most private forecasters interpreted that considerable period to mean anyway. So it's kind of strange that people were surprised by that number, indeed what the markets expected before.
But she's the boss, right? And it should be said, before we move on, Cardiff, that both Ben Bernanke and Alan Greenspan before her said some really not so good things right at the beginning of their terms. The whole world watches her.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was her first press conference. Yeah. She should have probably used language that was a little hazier in that specific case. She should have given herself a little more leeway. But you know what? This is going to happen. It's something that's easily fixable. I think you shouldn't be surprised if you see her in her next public appearance, maybe add some clarity to what she meant there.
Fair enough. The other thing I want to touch base with you guys on are these bank stress tests that the Fed has been running. They came out, I guess, yesterday. The results did. The top 30 banks are now deemed, 29 of the top 30 are deemed healthy enough to withstand a deep recession. Catherine, you feeling better about the banking system in this country because of that?
I guess.
You're all full of like meh today. I'm so unlike you.
So unlike me. Certainly the results from the Fed showed that or you know, they say that banks are in a better position today than they were 5 years ago. But that seems like kind of a low bar. I mean, five years ago they were in a pretty bad shape. There were a few banks that disputed the numbers and said, actually, we're in even better shape than the Fed says we are. And, you know, I'm more likely to believe the Fed's numbers than those of the banks themselves, since they They sort of have an incentive to say we're really safe and don't restrict what we can do.
Cardiff, quickly, what do you think?
Yeah, I think these stress tests are a good idea. I think they make sure that the banks, you know, remain sufficiently fortified, or at least more fortified than they otherwise would be against a potential crisis. That being said, I'm not actually worried about a crisis right now. Crises tend to begin in places that you don't expect when you're not paying attention. Right now, we're still paying attention to the health of banks. I'm more worried about the economy than I am about a potential financial crisis.
I feel so much better now. So much better. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Catherine Rampell from the Washington Post. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Guy.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, well, you're just going to have to wait, aren't you? We'll have the details when we do the number. With the price of crude oil closing at $99.98 in New York today, the oil and gas industry is slowly coming to terms with the truths of its business model. Finding and burning fossil fuels doesn't really work all that well if what you want to do is reduce global warming. And some shareholders have been after companies to do something about that, which is how we come to this. ExxonMobil releasing a report come the end of this month that will lay out the effect that carbon emissions rules will have on its bottom line. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more.
Mark Brownstein is with the Environmental Defense Fund. He says the fact that Exxon is releasing this report is a sign that the company has evolved its thinking on climate change.
Many years ago, they were thought to be the champions of the Climate Denier Club. And now what you're seeing is that there's a certain maturity, I think, a realization that the challenge is real.
The report that Exxon will release lays out the costs that carbon regulation will have on the company's future projects. For example, Exxon wants to extract billions of barrels of crude from tar sands in Canada. But that's an energy-intensive process, so the margins on profit are already narrow. And emissions regulations could make that margin even narrower. Just how narrow is exactly the kind of information that shareholders want to know.
They owe it to their shareholders. They have to state their position and educate the politician and the public about the ramification of imposing this cost, if you will.
Fadel Gate is a senior oil analyst with Oppenheimer. He says this report is necessary if Exxon wants to be a part of the debate over how to regulate carbon emissions.
It is probably the biggest issue that the world will have to grapple with. And Exxon, because of its position as the largest energy company in the world, they have to have a voice in the debate.
Exxon is the first major oil company to release this information, which sends a message to other shareholder activists that they, too, have a voice in this debate. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
After thousands of postcards from students asking him to show up, President Obama is going to give the commencement address at the University of California, Irvine, this June. You'd hope the president will have some valuable advice for the new graduates, but is there a value to the school of having a speech by the president? Sally Herships has that story.
Getting President Obama to speak at commencement is pretty much an academic marketer's dream. Just ask one.
Absolutely. It provides this sort of instant energy around the institution and conversation, which is wonderful.
Jeffrey Papa is president of Simpson Scarborough, a higher ed marketing firm. He's talking about how busy social media will likely be the day of the speech. He says for an organization to be able to align itself with the values of a star speaker is powerful, especially for academic institutions, which have to strike a delicate balance between looking prestigious and still getting the word out.
Higher education is a business.
And Papa says a competitive one. He says schools can spend up to $1 million on a marketing campaign for just one project. UC Irvine got lucky and scored a commander-in-chief.
And in particular, this president, there's probably just a little bit more hipness associated with his delivery.
Dan Hurley is with the American Association of State Colleges and Universities. He says it's unlikely the school could find another speaker who'd be this much of a media magnet.
Probably not. If they had a very large and successful football or basketball team, perhaps so.
UC Irvine had to get a stadium large enough to accommodate its special graduation at a cost of $1.2 million. But yesterday, there were 400 stories about its commencement in the news. With story number 401, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Borrowing money nowadays is just a whole lot harder than it used to be. And one of the things that started to happen as a result is a slew of new kinds of lending, including something called a workday loan, where you take loans or cash advances from your employer, which is, as it turns out, a whole different kind of risk. Gigi Duban reports now from Birmingham, Alabama.
Let's say someone has a car that breaks down. Got to get it fixed, right? But what if this person doesn't have the money? Not a whole lot of options.
Unfortunately, many of our consumers don't have access to traditional bank credit.
That's Ken Reese, CEO of Think Finance, a company that offers workplace loans. A lot of his consumers are folks like restaurant workers, hotel staff, even teachers and nurses. And he says a lot of times they can't get emergency credit, which is why his company offers a product called Elastic.
It's the choice between this product and a payday loan or this product and no access to credit at all.
Elastic lets employees borrow money through their employer. A worker can get a line of credit up to $1,000. There's a 5% fee for cash advances, plus other fees for higher loans.
They can get onto the website. We're able to ping that payroll system, know that they've been paid a certain amount, know that they are who they say they are, and then we're able to feel confident giving that customer the credit that they need.
How much credit depends on things like how long a person has been with a company and credit history. Employees can repay the loans by check or in cash, but usually these loans are repaid directly from a paycheck. Companies like Fairloan, a San Francisco-based lending startup, offer incentives for repaying a loan straight out of a paycheck. Alex Carlin is founder and CEO.
When you're applying for the loan, it's made very clear that if you want to pay from your paycheck, you have access to more credit. We limit loans that are not repaid through the paycheck to $500.
Carlin says repaying the loans out of a paycheck is safer for both the lender and the borrower. He says they're meant to be affordable. Interest rates start at 18%.
And the most expensive loan that we offer comes with a 30% interest rate and a 5% origination fee.
Carlin and other workplace lenders say that's way better than a payday loan, which can carry at least 300% annual interest. Plus, Carlin says his company reports info to the major credit bureaus, so it helps borrowers build credit. But critics say these types of loans can be just another kind of payday loan, especially for workers living paycheck to paycheck. Gary Kalman is with the Center for Responsible Lending.
So if somebody needs to pay groceries or pay their utility bills, they can't rearrange that debt because that's the first in line.
And he says lenders know it's extremely handy to be able to collect directly from someone's bank account.
In the past, lenders have offered such steep incentives for people to allow access to the bank account that they would give you free first loan, knowing that, you know, you're going to be coming back for more.
Even worse, he says, people will take out other loans to pay off the first one. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there are some things money can't buy. For everything else, there's MasterCard. Priceless.
What else is there to say, right? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 28 points today, almost 0.2%, closed at 16,302. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 42 points, about 1%. Ended things at 42.76. The S&P 500 slipped 5 points, 1/3%, 1866 there. For the week, the Dow up 1.4%. The NASDAQ hiked 0.7%. The S&P 500 picked up 0.3%. 5%. Nike slowed 5% today. Sales wouldn't climb as fast as expected was the rationale there. Symantec slumped 13%. The maker of antivirus software fired its CEO yesterday. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes down to 2.74%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Let's begin with some magic. Harry Houdini was born on March 24, 1874. Not an easy guy to lock up. Internet sources say he showed soldiers how to escape German handcuffs during World War I. First Lady Michelle Obama continues her travels through China. And you've got another week to enjoy National Umbrella Month. There would be so many bad hair days without the umbrella. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's going to be a Senate hearing next month into the big construction equipment maker Caterpillar and whether it perhaps improperly shifted profits abroad to dodge U.S. taxes. Caterpillar is not commenting, but when companies do get flack for moving money around the world, they usually say they pay their share and obey the law, which is usually true. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains how that usually works.
If you want to make sense of this, understand two things. First, don't think of these multinationals as single companies. Ed Kleinbard is the former chief of staff of Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation.
Whether it's Apple or General Motors or General Electric, it doesn't matter. These, in fact, are constellations of hundreds of companies located all over the world.
Second, remember, companies don't just make money off stuff. They profit from ideas.
What makes a Nike sneaker more valuable than an Acme sneaker? It's the intangible assets associated with that company. It's the brand name, it's the secret sauce, it's the patents.
An American firm can move those intangible assets to a foreign arm in a tax haven, all with the stroke of a pen. So piles of money a drug company, for example, might make from its research are off limits to the IRS. David K. Johnston at Syracuse's law school thinks this is all unfair to small business.
If you own a purely domestic company, and that's the mom and pop businesses, the family businesses in America, you are not allowed to do this.
Rebecca Wilkins is with Citizens for Tax Justice, which thinks these multinationals should pay more. When they say they're just following the law, that's not enough for her.
They act as if they're innocent in this whole process, and quite the opposite is true. They have lobbied for these tax breaks.
Unless Congress changes the law, American companies will keep paying accountants to take full advantage. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We're all getting older. That's just a fact. But that means the people who care for us as we get older are aging, too. The number of older caregivers, that is, over the age of 55, is growing. They're nearly a quarter of that slice of the labor pool, working mostly in private homes, taking care of people who sometimes aren't a whole lot older than they are. Kate Davidson reports.
It's lunchtime, and Maggie Valenti is struggling with a package of sliced cheese.
I don't have a lot of feeling in my fingers. They're not strong anymore.
Valenti is 79, a grandmother and a great-grandmother.
And I know I've taken cheese out of here.
She's also the paid caregiver to this man.
I'm Carl Sinderman. I'm 91, so they tell me anyway.
And his wife Joan, also 91. The couple served in World War II, their caregiver during Korea. Valenti cooks meals, watches their meds, and does light housekeeping 40 hours a week in their Maryland home. Everyone loves this arrangement.
Well, she's almost a family member, of course. The only difference being we can pay her. That's about the only difference.
This field is growing as rapidly as the country is aging. More than a million new direct care jobs are expected by 2022, many filled by people over 55. And while those who care for our elderly are themselves graying, they face the same low wages as younger home care workers.
These are pretty poor quality jobs, generally speaking.
Abby Marquand works with PHI. It's a nonprofit that tries to improve the quality of direct care jobs.
We're talking about near poverty level wages, very few employment benefits like employer-sponsored health insurance or paid sick leave, and really high rates of injury.
Especially in nursing home settings, though most older caregivers do work in private homes. PHI says the median wage for a home caregiver like Maggie Valenti is about $10 an hour.
And actually, more than half of these workers are relying on some form of public assistance for their households. So they rely on Medicaid themselves or food stamps.
Valenti, though, is not complaining. The paycheck means she's able to help her daughter pay for medicine. Besides, when she started looking for work again at age 77, her options were limited.
Dunkin' Donuts called me. They'd accepted my application. And I'm thinking, oh, no, no, this is not what I want to do. And then the Home Instead had an ad in the paper.
At the Home Instead Senior Care franchise where Valenti works, almost half her coworkers are over 51. And there are challenges in this job regardless of age.
When she fell down one morning, and it's like the rules with Home Instead, you don't pick them up. I says, I can't pick you up. You're going to have to crawl in the living room. And by the time she got back, crawling looked like a crab, we were both laughing so hard.
So glad she was safe. And Maggie Valenti was glad that when she had to keep working, she found what she wanted to do. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
The first half of the last season of Mad Men is well nigh upon us. April 13th is the premiere, and yes, they are going to draw it out to get ratings, but that's a whole different story. If you're a fan of the show, and probably if you're not, you know the ad world is as much about psychology as it is about commerce, and that there are campaigns that go beyond just boosting sales and creating buzz. They become almost a part of the culture. Just Do It from Nike. Where's the Beef from Wendy's, right? 17 years ago, a team at the ad agency McCann Erickson came up with a slogan that didn't just close the gap between its client, MasterCard, and MasterCard's biggest competitor, Visa. It became shorthand for the stuff that is really important in life. Kevin Allen led that team at McCann, part of his 30 years in the business. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I was going to ask you to read it for me, but you probably know it by heart, right? You probably have it memorized?
Yeah.
All right, hit it.
There are some things money can't buy, for everything else is MasterCard. Priceless.
What's it like to be a guy who helped create something that is fundamental in American advertising?
Well, it is. I'll put it to you this way. When I was coming up in the business, Mom would call me every so often and say, Ella, so what is it you do? And I know
your
what she
mom
was doing.
Does that too.
Yeah. You know. I mean, how many people can describe to their mothers what they do? Yeah. And I know what it was. She was talking to my neighbor, whose son, the doctor, would be bragging, and Mom couldn't have any bragging rights. When I was able to say that I was part of creating the Priceless campaign for MasterCard, of course, she tells everybody I wrote it, I produced it, I acted in it. You know,
yeah,
the whole
you did the whole thing, yeah.
it's life-changing coming up with something like that, no question.
What was the pitch meeting like? You call MasterCard in, or I guess you go see them, and
yes.
You said, we've got this idea. Here it is, basically.
It's very, very rare that you present something in the pitch room that ends up on air. I think maybe it's happened to me twice. Yeah, it's happened maybe a couple times in my career. And, I mean, it was probably one of the longest reviews in a long time. And everybody knew, I mean, that was, I don't know, about 6 months long, that it would change the lives of anybody who was involved in it. Although, I will tell you, no one had any idea that it would go as far as it went. It's still in, I don't know, dozens and dozens of countries around the world.
Here's the thing, though, Kevin. I mean, so 97 World Series was when that ad aired for the first time was, where are we now? 17 years ago, right? This fall will be 17 years.
Yeah.
The changes in this economy and society are staggering.
Yes.
Could you have a thing that connects that well today? I'm trying to think of something in the last, 18 months, 2 years that has really hit. And I don't know.
It's really – it's funny. I think I would call the old days the supply economy, you know, and it was a nice, neat little world where we controlled everything.
Hmm.
Like when I was a young account exec, my job was monitoring out of stocks. They used to call it OOS.
Yeah.
And that meant if a product was out of stock in Cleveland, I'd turn the advertising off.
Really? So no more TV spots and no more news ads in Cleveland for whatever?
Yeah. As soon as it went back on the shelf again, on goes the advertising and everything flies off the shelf. And when I tell those stories now to young marketers, they giggle. They're like, you got to be kidding me. And it's because of the, I suppose, the sort of ultimate democratization that has occurred in general as a result of technology and the internet. You know, the customer is firmly in charge. They're the ones in charge of it, and they'll tell us so.
If this is your big idea, if you don't have another billion-dollar idea, but if the Priceless campaign is what your reputation stands on, you all right with that?
You know, I am, and I'll tell you why. Because I think that what it stands for is not that, you know, we tricked them or it was some slick bit of execution. It was based upon something that I heard when I was a kid, you know. There's more important things in life than money. You know, we came from nothing. You know, single mom raised four kids, that stuff. And it's funny how you hear that stuff as a kid. And I think about the creators of that campaign who came up with the idea based upon a simple human truth. You know, I left the agency for the day to take my kid to a baseball game. And you can't put money on that. Hmm. So, yeah, I would for sure.
Kevin Allen, you know him from McCann Erickson and MasterCard and the Priceless Campaign, a bunch of others too. Kevin, thanks very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Kevin's got a new book out about his career in the ad business. It's called The Case of the Missing Cutlery.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today. Today is Twitter's 8th birthday, as you may know. And so to mark the moment, they have set up a way to find out what people's first tweet was. Most were, hey, I guess I'm on Twitter now, or something lame like that. Vladimir Putin's first tweet? Congratulations to U.S. President-elect Barack Obama. Times they do change, huh? All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. No, you don't want to know what my first tweet was. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yor. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.